This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on personal injury. I'm joined by barrister John Assad from 33 Bedford Row Chambers in London. John has been instructed in very high-value personal injury cases on behalf of several government bodies, including the Ministry of Defence and the Ministry of Justice. He is particularly apt at dealing with vulnerable witnesses, and his advocacy has been praised by judges of the highest level. Thank you very much for joining me, John.
Thank you very much for having me, Hattie. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast.
And it's a pleasure to have you. So, personal injury. I don't think personal injury is a sort of term that we haven't heard of. I think actually it's been forced into our heads through so much advertising over the years, personal injury claims. But let's just tell our listeners to start off with, what do we mean by personal injury when we say that? What are we talking about?
Personal injury is a term we use when talking about injuries that broadly fall into two categories. We have physical injuries, like a broken bone or a sprain, and we have psychological injuries like PTSD or depression. So there's a wide range of injuries from something like mild whiplash to permanent physical or mental disability. So all of this falls under the umbrella term of personal injury, and the body of personal injury law is that area of law that deals with claims arising out of such injuries.
Okay, well, I have to say, the personal injury market in 2018, which is, you know, almost 2 years ago, was valued then at £4 billion a year, which is a lot of money. So there's a lot of business going on in this world of personal injury. So let's talk about in what situations might someone be able to bring a claim for personal injury, i.e., you know, road traffic, public place, workplace. Let's talk about some of those examples, please.
Well, to bring a claim for personal injury, generally, you need to be able to prove three things. You need to prove that someone owed you what we call a duty of care, that they breached that duty, and that their breach caused your injury. And this is what we know as the law of negligence. So you can bring a claim for personal injury whenever somebody negligently causes you to sustain an injury. So day to day, people will owe us a duty of care as we go about our lives. For example, those examples you mentioned, a road user. Another driver could collide with your vehicle. You might be able to bring a claim there if you're injured. With your employer, if your employer doesn't provide you with safe equipment in, for example, a factory or a kitchen and you injure yourself, again, there might be a claim for you there. Public authorities, you're walking along the streets, there's an open manhole that you fall through, you might be able to bring a claim. There's a very famous case that I think all law students would know about, the case of Donoghue and Stevenson, 1932. Now, in this case, the claimant had gone to a cafe and she was with her friend. She'd ordered the ginger beer and she was drinking that beer. When she got to the end of it, she looked inside and she saw a dead decomposing snail.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting you to say that, but go ahead.
Famous case. She then gets unwell as a result of drinking that, and she decides to bring a claim against the manufacturer of the ginger beer.
Not the locality that she was having the beer at?
No, the manufacturer of that beer itself.
Right.
So she brings that claim, and that claim makes its way up all the way to the highest court in the land, back then known as the House of Lords, which we now know as the Supreme Court. And the House of Lords found that the manufacturer of the beer owed the claimant a duty of care. The manufacturer should have made sure that their product was safe for the ultimate consumer. And it wasn't. She became unwell, and she was able to bring a claim. They had a duty. They breached that duty. That caused her injury. So she could bring a claim, and her claim was successful. So that's just an example to show that it really does encompass day-to-day life.
Well, you say 1932. Is that sort of, I hesitate when I say this, but is that a record of the first personal injury claim that was brought, do you think then, John? Or do you think there was ones other before that probably?
There likely would have been cases before that, but this is a case where they deal really with the question of, to whom do I owe that duty of care?
Right.
And it gets to a very high level to answer that question. And the court is dealing with that question of who is my neighbour?
Yes.
And it's saying anybody that could suffer as a result of your actions.
Well, interestingly, you'd think then, if that was going on in 1932, which, OK, we're only in 2020, so we're not quite yet 100 years away from that. But you'd think that it's actually developed quite slowly then, personal injury claims, because it's only really in the last, 15 years, 20 years, perhaps, that the world, you know, has gone crazy about personal injury claims. I think, you know, it all stems from the US and it all kind of started out there to become bigger and more of it was going on. And then all of a sudden in the UK, everything was about personal injury claims. I mean, an online portal called The Business Wire reported that personal injury claims were dominated by road traffic accidents and industrial accidents. And I think they're talking about what globally makes the majority of personal injury claims that are out there. OK, I mean, that's all very helpful, very useful, I have to say, to know. And I would never have naturally thought that in 1932 personal injury claims were being brought. I don't know why. I just never have thought that. But that's all good. So let's talk about actually a personal injury claim. Is there a time limit? So we're talking about time limitation to bring personal injury claims. Let's talk about that, please.
There is a time limit for bringing a personal injury claim. It's shorter than other types of claims that somebody might bring. For personal injury, you have 3 years to bring that claim. Now, this is where it gets a little bit more complicated and where I suggest people should seek legal advice.
Yes. Complicated and the law? No, I'd never think that. Yes.
The question is, when does the 3 years begin to run? So I'll tell you what the law says, and then I'll tell you what it practically means.
Yes, let's tell our listeners what it means in plain, simple, old English as well, please.
Of course. So what the law says is that you need to bring the claim within 3 years from the date on which the cause of action accrued. And that means that normally it's from the date of the breach of duty or 3 years from the date of knowledge of the person injured, if later. So in practical terms, that would mean 3 years from the date of the incident. For example, 3 years from the date of your car accident, 3 years from the date that you fell when you were doing your shopping, from 3 years from the date when you drank a beer that had a dead snail inside.
Hopefully not. But you're talking about a single incident, an injury that was caused by a single incident, 3 years from the date that single incident took place.
Yes. Now, the alternative is when it might not be a single incident. It might be something that continues for some time and you aren't aware that there has been a breach of duty that has caused you an injury till later. So your knowledge of it doesn't come till later. So I'll give you an example for that. It might be that you're a fireman and you've been working with the fire brigade 20 years ago and you were negligently exposed to certain harmful gases. At the time, you didn't realize that you were suffering as a result of this. You sustained an injury as a result of this. But very recently, you've been diagnosed with a respiratory condition that the doctors and the experts say, well, this must have come from your time at the fire brigade.
Relating it to the potential gases and things. Yeah.
Exactly. So you're out of time with the 3 years from when you're actually exposed, but you could bring the claim on the basis that this is within the 3 years from your date of knowledge.
No, that's very helpful and that's very useful because I tell you, time limitation, and I've said this on many a podcast before, is one of the single most important things when considering any claim or action, because being out of time is out of time. So it's so crucial and important not to leave something if it has a time limitation like this in order to bring your claim. So let's talk about what happens if somebody is partially at fault for an accident that's happened. So they're thinking, well, that accident happened, but I should have perhaps been more careful, or I had something to do with that, but the injury's been caused. Is there a personal injury claim there for that person?
There is, or there could be. So if you're partially at fault for the accident and that partial fault contributed to the injuries, that doesn't stop you from bringing a claim. You'd bring a claim in the normal way, but the other side will try to prove to the court that you've contributed to the accident in some way. So if the court thinks that on balance you did contribute to the accident, then the court will reduce your damages, which is the amount of money you'll get paid out, to the extent that it believes you contributed. So this is known as contributory negligence. Again, let's take an example. If you're walking down the streets, your eyes are glued to your phone, you fall down an open manhole.
I just want to say, the amount of people I see walking down the streets with their eyes glued to the phone, I'm actually a victim of that as well. But carry on. Sorry, I just thought I'd throw that in there.
I think we all are. Then you bring a claim against the council and say that they were negligent for leaving that open manhole in the streets. The council could then go to court and argue, if you were looking ahead of you, you would have seen the big red arrows and the sign and bright lights that said, caution, open manhole. And then it's for the court to decide if not looking contributed to the accident. And the result could be, for example, that 40% of the accident was your fault for not looking, but 60% was the council's fault for leaving that manhole uncovered.
Yes. No, I have to say, your examples are brilliant. They work. They're real. And I can relate to them. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be able to relate to your examples as well, because, as I said, they're quite real examples. Now, let's talk about, John, can someone under the age of 18 bring a claim for personal injury?
Yes, they can bring a claim. There are some differences if you are under 18, if you are a child. They would need to bring a claim with someone known as their litigation friend. And that's a technical term used in these types of proceedings as someone who effectively supports them through the case. And normally that person is their parent. The proceedings would follow generally the same route as an adult, but there are some differences, primarily when it comes to settlement of the case. If the parties settle, that would need to go to court, and the court would need to approve the settlement. With an adult, it doesn't need to go to court. If I'm bringing a claim and I settle with the other side, I accept an offer, that would be the end of matters, but not so for a child. The court needs to look at that offer to make sure that nobody's taking advantage of that child.
Right.
Because it's all adults in their life, and the child doesn't necessarily know what's in their best interest. So the court will look over this whole process.
So the court will have the last say. There will not necessarily be a court hearing, but the agreement, should we say, the settlement will go to court, and a judge will cast their eye, look over it, and make sure that it's a fair and reasonable agreement in favour of the minor. Obviously, meaning not in favour of the minor, in meaning that the minor gets the best, you know, is in the best position, but making sure there's no advantage being taken of the fact that there is a child involved as the main, as the claimant of the case.
Exactly. Right. There normally are hearings, infant settlement hearings. So normally we do go to court to deal with this because there is some paperwork that needs to be dealt with. And that specifically relates to the second difference, and that is that for a child, the money that would be paid out doesn't get paid, normally won't get paid directly to the child. Normally what happens with that money is that it gets paid into a court fund, and the court invests that money. And that money will then get paid out to the child once they turn 18.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's very interesting. I have to say, I've never really thought about, can children bring a claim for personal injury? But, you know, if something's happened, again, a slip or a fall or unfortunate a car accident or something like that, then why not? You know, they have the complete right to do so. So let's talk about the types of losses that someone can claim for, other than the actual injury itself. So outside the actual injury, whether it's, you know, a broken arm or a, you know, whiplash or whatever it may be, what other types of losses can somebody claim for, John?
So losses broadly fall into two categories. You have general damages and you have special damages. General damages are what you've referred to as for the actual injury. And that is what we call PSLA, which means pain, suffering, loss of amenity as a result of the actual injury. But the more specific category is special damages. And that covers most other heads of loss. This can relate to past losses and to future losses. Some examples are loss of earnings, travel expenses for going to the GP after an accident, going to the hospital, cost of medication you've had to buy, cost of any sort of physiotherapy that's required. But there's also non-injury related losses that you can claim for. If you're in a car accident, the cost of repairing the vehicle after the accident would fall under this category of special damages.
Okay. I mean, I guess there is a whole host of things. And I think the key point here is if there is a financial loss to you, financial being the key word here, as a result of the accident, then everything really should be and can be taken into consideration if that accident has been the direct cause of that financial loss or, you know, that's got to be the key message, hasn't it, really, there? I mean, we know that there's been new reforms implemented through the Civil Liability Bill, which brought about a significant reduction in whiplash compensation claims and other types of small personal injury claims. There's been caps put up. I mean, one of the statistics that I read recently about personal injury claims is that 58% of payouts on claims were £5,000 or less. And I'm talking about in the UK here, which is quite interesting. But let's talk about other elements of a personal injury claim now, John. I mean, how does a court determine how much money somebody should get for an injury? And let's talk about the injury here and not the other losses that somebody could have suffered.
This is not an exact science. It depends what the judge had for breakfast.
Oh, I love that.
Two different judges can make very different awards for the same type of injury. The same judge can make different awards before and after lunch. There is useful guidance for judges and for lawyers to help them determine what an injury is worth. So there's a book known as the Judicial College Guidelines. The proper title for it is the Guidelines for the Assessment of General Damages and Personal Injury Cases. This book, it's published annually, and it categorizes injuries into different groups. You've got, for example, orthopedic injuries and psychiatric injuries as two separate categories. Then within each category, it sets out the factors to be taken into consideration, and it splits the category based on the severity of the injury and the duration of the injury. And then for each of these final categories, subcategories, it provides a range for each injury. And that helps the court broadly to what sort of award it should be giving for this case.
I mean, I get it. It's not so easy as to say, look, if you've got a broken leg as a result of a car accident, then you're guaranteed or you're looking at getting about £2,000. It just doesn't work like that. And I think you're absolutely right. The court will make the decision based on all the merits of the case. And, you know, you should most certainly consider being legally represented in such a claim, and your lawyers hopefully will guide you down the right path of what you should be getting based on other cases that have been similar, very similar, if not almost the same as to what you're claiming. Let's talk about medical records, because this is a question that gets asked to us quite regularly about personal injury claims. Does somebody's medical records get looked into if they make a personal injury claim? And I'm talking about their medical history prior to the accident, incident, etc. Do they get looked at as part of the claim by potentially the defendant in circumstances of personal injury claims?
It depends on a number of different factors. It depends on the seriousness of the injury, the complexity of the injury, the value of the claim, and whether the case settles early or whether it goes to final contested trial. So if this is just a small, very minor injury, a sprain, something like that, it's unlikely that there would be a need for full disclosure of all your medical records for such a small injury, because it would just be disproportionate. Normally, something like that, you would go to a GP, get a short medical report that deals with the points that need to be addressed for this, and that would be good enough. The GP might, of course, look at your medical records to help them make their assessment, but that doesn't mean that needs to be disclosed to the defendant. If it's a complex injury that's resulted in profound disability, for example, it's almost certain that you'll need to disclose your medical records, and for good reason. The defendants do have the right to test your case. You might be saying, I have this injury and this serious injury has arisen.
I was just going to say, as a result of that incident that we're at court arguing about. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. The defendants can then look at your medical records and then point to specific entries that suggest that this injury, the one that you're complaining of now, existed long before this accident happened. So they would say that we didn't cause it. We may have breached our duty to you, and we might accept that, but nevertheless, we should not pay you anything because we did not cause the injury of which you are now complaining. So yes. It depends where you fall in the spectrum there.
Yes, I mean, it could be that as a result of the accident, your injury was agitated and it's become worse. I mean, there's just different levels of it. But I think it has to be right. You know, if you're saying to somebody, this has happened because of you, your medical records will be telling as to whether you had that condition before. Maybe you had it many years ago and it got better. And as a result of the accident, it agitated and brought it back to life. And there'll be different considerations by the court for incidents like that, I'm sure. Let's talk about how people pay for personal injury claims. Now, I have to say that in 2019, it was reported that over half of claimants received the compensation they expected or even more. And it also says that most claims, personal injury claims, this was in the PR Newswire article, were led by no-win, no-fee legal services. So if someone doesn't have the money to hire lawyers to run these sorts of claims for them, what do they do? I mean, is it so? I mean, I know that there's lots of no-win, no-fee lawyers out there, and that's probably the route it will go. The insurers are the first people to sit there and recommend lawyers to, aren't they, John, in these incidences?
Yeah, no-win, no-fee is very, very common because a lot of people can't afford to hire lawyers. So in the area of personal injury, there is this prevalence of no win, no fee, which we refer to as a conditional fee agreement that you would enter into with these firm of solicitors. So those solicitors would normally look over your case, think about the prospects of success, whether this case could be successful, to what extent, and then they would reach an agreement tailored to you as to how they will be paid if you are successful. So if you do bring that claim and you win, their fee would be paid out of those damages. If you bring a claim and you lose, then based on your agreement, you'd have nothing to pay. No win, no fee.
Yes, I mean, what I would say is I know that solicitors, client care letters and fee agreements can be long, drawn-out documents, but do take the time and do read them, because there could be something in there that, you know, isn't so favourable to you, more likely than not, but there could be. So just do take the time to at least do that, even though you won't be running your case, your personal injury case, do take the time to try and read the paperwork and agreement between you and a legal firm. And we've got time to discuss one more area, John. And this, again, is another big question that's asked. Actually, most people ask this at the time that they engage with a solicitor for personal injury claims or no-win, no-fee arrangements. So if somebody brings a claim and they don't succeed in court, it fails, your claim's not successful, will they have to pay for the other side's legal costs in these typical no-win, no-fee agreements?
This is a complicated question.
I saved the best for last. There you go.
Whether a claimant needs to pay for the defendant's legal costs if their claim is unsuccessful. And the reason being, generally in civil cases, and personal injury is a type of civil case, a case heard in the county court, the rule of thumb is that the loser pays the winner's legal fees. So you as the claimant, you bring a claim, you lose. The rule of thumb in the civil courts is that you will pay the winner's cost, the defendant's cost. The exception is personal injury cases, because there's something known as qualified one-way costs shifting, QOCS. Now, I'll tell you what that means. The QOCS regime is complex, so I'm not going to go into the details of how it works, but I'll give you the practical effect of what QOCS protection is. With QOCS protection, which only applies to a claimant, if you bring a claim and you lose, you won't have to pay the defendant's legal costs. If you bring a claim and lose, you won't have to pay the defendant's legal costs. If you bring a claim and you win, the defendant should pay your legal costs, or at least a large proportion of your legal costs. It only protects you, doesn't protect them. Then there's the gray area in the middle where you've brought a claim, but you've only won to a certain small extent of your claim. So there's no clear winner and loser in this case. So the court might in that case still order you to pay the defendant's costs, but you only pay to the extent to which you won. Now let's unpack that very briefly. If let's say you brought a claim for £100,000, but you're awarded damages of £1,000, a nominal £1,000, the court orders you still to pay the defendant's legal costs because the defendant was entitled to defend this claim. You didn't really clearly win. The defendant's legal costs, let's say, are £200,000. You won't be ordered to pay, or you won't be required to pay the full £200,000. You'll only be required to pay the £1,000, the extent to which you won.
So because it was a nominal win. But we're saying here, if you lose the claim in a personal injury case, and we're taking personal injury cases, you know, in it's the most common forms of personal injury cases. If you lose in court and you're on a no win, no fee with your lawyers, will you have to pay the other side's costs? How common is that?
No, you won't have to pay the other side's costs, except if you are found to have been fundamentally dishonest.
Yes, yes.
If your claim was just a lie, if you've made things up, then the court will say, as a punishment, effectively, you will have to pay the defendant's
Could
legal
say,
costs.
Yeah. No, and I totally get that. Because if it's a case that, do you know what, as an employer or as a corporate body or as anybody, because you can have a personal injury claim made against you by somebody who says, you know, you were negligent in some form. And that claim is completely a lie, and there's no substance to it whatsoever, that person has had to, you know, spend money, or that corporate body and business, defending that. So if it is found that it was based on a pack of lies just to try and extort money out of a company or a person or people, then the court could say you have to pay the cost. But if that's not the case, and on the merits of the case, the judge says, look, you know, I'm just not awarding you this claim, and you lose your claim on that basis, it's unlikely that you will be asked to pay the other side's costs, even though the other side have incurred costs. John, yes, that is all we have time for today.
Thank you very much, Hattie. It's been a pleasure.
So thank you. Thank you so much for your time. I really love the way that you just threw in some great examples in there, because I do think it helps us understand, you know, these areas. And I know that this is an introductory part one of personal injury, and I am looking forward to doing a part two of this podcast, because I do think that we can then go in a bit deeper and expand on certain areas of personal injury cases that, you know, people may want to hear about. So once again, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Hattie.
And what I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts, and you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.